nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
Okay, so to this point we have discussed the effects of reaction rate, the different material limitations such as tortuosity and and electrical conductivity. Now I want to add the missing piece, which is diffusion, and then try to put everything together, okay? Really, the problem boils down to coming up with an equation of continuity that accounts for the transfer of mass and charge and heat in the system, okay? Overall, and the final equation, well, it hasn't been animated there, but really, I guess conceptually, what in order to describe a battery, we need to account for charge, mass, and heat conservation. There is heat in the sense that when joule heated is generated during these reactions, that heat has to be transferred, and of course if it accumulates, then bad things may happen. Okay? There is mass in the sense that when the reaction proceeds, the ionized material and the electrons basically are exuded into the electrolyte, and then they have to diffuse into the counter electrode and react there. Okay, so we have to account in that sense for its chemical and electrical nature, and it has to be accounted simultaneously. Okay, and because the system is a conserved system, okay, then we want to cast an equation that captures that. Okay, so for that box that I drew up there on the board, on the screen, basically what we're saying is that the total amount of mass, think of this one as in moles or in grams, should be equal to how much mass goes inside that box minus how much mass actually manages to come out. Okay, for this all happens between T and T plus dt, okay, but between two infinitesimal instants, okay? So infinitesimally small instance, okay, and in this case, what comes in is the mass flux that hits one of these faces, okay, and that would be J x minus dx over 2, okay, times the cross-section of the area, which in this case is dy dz, okay, that's what goes in, right, what comes out? Okay, again, this one, of course, right now has units, since the flux has units of mass per unit area per second, this product has units of mass per second. So then I multiply the whole thing by the amount of time that elapsed. So that's how much it accumulated in that box, in that instant. Okay, and well, in principle, we don't know what J is. Okay, in fact, this is one of the a lot of changes or additions you can put into that contribution. But really, this flux of charge or mass or heat, okay, is really a function of the driving forces, right? Could be a function of the gradients. Put it here, all of these are gradients. Gradients of mass, charge, and temperature. Actually, here we can put voltage. Okay. Those are the quantities that go in here. Okay. I don't know the shape of this equation, of this function right now. Okay. But I want to be able to say something about the mass accumulation or the charge accumulation for that matter. Okay. So, since I don't know exactly the shape of this, as it varies continuously as I go from one side of the box to the other side, all I can say is that if my box is very, very small, I can expand that thing in Taylor series. Okay, all I did is expand it to first order for this Taylor series because dx, the length of the box is really small, so I can do that. Okay, and the same I can say for the other one. Okay, and I still have okay. And I can, in principle, just substitute it in there. Okay, which I'm going to do right here. In fact, since I have dy, dz, multiplying both of them, I'm just going to pre-multiply them. And I think you can see that this j has a minus sign, goes away with that j. I can get rid of these two. And since there's a minus sign in front of these two, then I really end up with minus dx, dy, dz, dt, dj, dx. Okay, that's a minus sign over there. Okay, and, well, I still have to say something about this dm, okay? I can say, actually, I'm going to put it on this other end, that dm really corresponds to the actual concentration in the system, so I can say it's dx, dy, dz times whatever that concentration is, okay? So then that allows me to cancel this dx with that dx, this dy with this dy, and dz with dz, okay? And because of that, I can say that for charge, mass, and heat, the density, if you may, the concentration of that stuff, okay, okay, which of course I can rewrite as okay, which is basically Fick's law, okay. This, of course, in one dimension, you can repeat the whole exercise putting the y components and the z components of flux. And so, extension to 3D, this djx dx, okay, just basically the accumulation of the gradients across the infinitesimally small box. Or if you prefer, minus the divergence of the flux as it goes through. Okay, that's assuming no reactions inside the box. Okay? If there are reactions inside the box, then we would have to do the whole exercise again and add a volumetric reaction to the system, which will add an additional term over here. Okay? So it's just the same exercise. Okay? To this point, it's all math, okay? But you end up with equations that look like that for charge and mass, okay? And all we're doing here is just, what we're mathematically saying here is that whatever mass goes into the system is the same mass we get out, and whatever charge we put in the system is the same charge we get out, okay? So, and we should, right? Because if we don't, well, besides the fact that we would be violating these fundamental principles, then we would be losing charge in our battery, and we don't want that. Okay, so those are the relationships, right? And oh, and actually, we still have the problem, right? We still don't know what J is. Okay, J is the big unknown here. Okay, and also in early on the, well, somewhere in the second quarter of the 20th century, people started to look at these fluxes, right, and mathematical representations that would go beyond what has been traditionally known. Okay, and what we find is that because in general, these fluxes, heat fluxes or mass fluxes or charge fluxes, are functions of these individual driving forces. Okay, we can perform the exact same exercise we just did for the fluxes as we have them on the board, right? If we don't know how it behaves, all I can say is that I can expand each of these fluxes in Taylor series. Okay, and then figure out later what the rest of the coefficients mean. Okay, and well, that's what was done by Onsager. Okay, and I'm going to erase this bit. And well, we keep those equations, or the equations that you have up on the screen. Okay, those we keep, but we still need to say something about the fluxes. So I can say that any generalized flux, which is a function of the heat flux, or some driving force as a result of that induces heat, a driving force that induces charge motion, or a driving force associated to the first component or any other component, or any generalized driving force that you may have, to a first approximation, if these driving forces are small, if the deviations are small with respect to equilibrium, then you can say this. Basically, we are saying that the driving forces imposes fluxes, imposes charge and mass and heat flow, and to a first approximation, though that flux is linear with respect to the gradients, okay, of those forces, okay, and these coefficients are still unknown, but now we have reduced this complicated problem into something that we can actually measure experimentally, okay. These coefficients, again, you can measure them. Oh, and I forgot to put this one here as F1. Okay, and well, you can see how the rest of the mathematics proceed. Okay, I guess at some level what we did is we shifted our ignorance from not knowing what the mathematical shape of this flux is. We shifted it in its entirety to obtaining the coefficients between the driving forces and the actual effective flux. So you can take that flux, for example, that J, and dump it in here and then have one equation. Okay? But then I would have to do it not only for the mass flux, I would have to do it for the charge flux too. Okay? And that's still, I still don't know what those coefficients are. Now I have exchanged one problem for the other one, right? Okay? And, well, on the slide, basically save us like 5 minutes of board work. And what that does is just basically expands in Taylor series every single one of those fluxes that we may have. Okay? For heat flux, for example, you can see now it's going to be proportional to some driving force that imposes that motion of heat, of thermal energy, some driving forces that would usually impose charge motion. Okay, but in this case, that same driving force also imposes heat flux. And the same when you have some driving force for So I'm driving force for mass flow. Now that same driving force will induce some heat flow in the system, okay? And all of them are, you can see they're all coupled, so you can even write it in matrix form, okay? Because now you can think of, now I have this mega vector, right? Because this JQ is really just symbolic to say is the X component of heat flux, the Y component of heat flux, and the Z component of heat flux, all of them bundle here into that symbol, okay? So basically you have a 3 by, well, this is a 3 by 1, but each of these contributions are basically tensor multiplications that you add on it. And well, I really don't want to get much into the math, just emphasize that. And we still have to specify what these coefficients mean. And really what people do is they just say, well, I'm going to call this coefficient LIQ. I'm going to call this other coefficient LI rho. This other coefficient, instead of carrying that whole thing, I'm just going to call this coefficient LI1. And, you know, so on and so forth. And eventually, of course, I will find that there's a coefficient LII that I have to find, okay, that I can put every single of those coefficients into this giant matrix of missing coefficients that I don't have. Okay, on Sagar, as he went over these different driving forces, he found that there are some constraints imposed on them that really actually make you this n by n matrix can really be simplified, and the constraints were very straightforward in that sense. Okay, and before I talk about that, I want to say that you have the flux that we've been talking about, the force, the driving force that imposes that, and what empirical relationship we already know. Whatever relationship we write here or we come up with in this Taylor expansion that we have just created, that we had just made, that Taylor expansion should eventually reduce to something that we have seen before or should capture it in a more general sense. So, for example, for heat, the driving force corresponds to the gradients of temperature. Okay, we know that if there's a temperature difference between two spots, there's going to be a driving force from the hot spot to the cold spot, right? And those driving forces are proportional to the gradient. Okay, so that force, that driving force, is what controls heat or heat flux. And that's typically specified in terms of Fick's second law. And so in that sense, if we were to write it in this context, heat flow could be related to the gradient of temperature in this way. Or if you prefer, assuming every other driving force to be turned off, we can say, I'm going to raise this. I can say that for heat, I know this is a function of some driving force, in this case, some heat-related thermal driving force, some charge driving force, and all the different chemical driving forces in general, okay? But if I turn everything off, the only thing left would be that one, and if I expand that in Taylor series, okay, which I can associate that FQ to that number over there, and then say, oh, this number over here is really related to the thermal conductivity of the system, which I can readily put in there. Okay? At least that's the initial thought. Okay? At least that's the idea in that sense. Okay? And, well, you can do the exact same thing for mass flux, right, where in this case the gradients of chemical potential are the ones that impose motion of mass from one spot to the other one. And as a result, we get another functional form for Fick's second law. Okay, in this case, instead of having heat going from a hot spot to a cold spot, in this case, we get mass going from a high concentration region to a low concentration region, or to be more general, mass goes from a high chemical potential region to a low chemical potential region unless you do something in addition to. Okay, and finally, same for charge, okay? The driving force F sub rho corresponds to the gradient of voltage, okay? The electric field, and as a result of that, we get what people know as Ohm's law, or you can think of it as the electrical version of Fick's second law. Okay? Again, this is a generalization based on what people have known in the past, and Onsager cast it, and those coefficients are determined in that way. Okay? Any questions at this point? Yeah?
The one for each would be Fourier's law, right?
Say that again?
The one for each would be Fourier's law?
Yeah, well, they also call it Fick's law, but yes, you're right. It's also referred to as Fourier's law. Yeah, it gets depend on the field as well. What? Yeah. Okay, that's fine. Yeah, well, I guess I can go and edit that into Fourier's law too. Yeah, no, that's fine. I've also seen it in that context. Okay, any other questions? No? Okay. So the same way you have defined that driving force, think of this driving force, you know, gradients of voltage, of gradients of chemical potential. Okay? And now in this case, the mass flux is going to be a linear combination of those driving forces, and the trick is to figure out those coefficients. Okay? So if I have, well, in this case, n plus 2 driving forces, that means I will have an n plus 2 times n plus 2 matrix whose coefficients I have to figure out. And in this case, they seem to be coupled, and that's a mess, right? It seems that that's a big problem, okay? Of course, you can always come up with an experiment that allows you to determine it very analytically, okay? Turns out that Lars Onsager found that those coefficients are actually constrained, okay? Meaning that the off-diagonal terms between, let's put it this way, the coefficient that relates, for example, charge and composition for flux also couples the coefficient that relates composition and charge in the other equation, okay? So in other words, the coefficients, the QI term, the rho I term, it's exactly equal to the I rho term, okay? And that's a constraint that it's necessary so that when mass and heat and charge are flowing, the entropy of the system increases, okay? If at all, it has to remain flat, okay? In other words, it shouldn't, either the total entropy of the system remains conserved or the entropy should go up. The entropy should be generated during this reversible transfer process, okay? I'm not gonna go over those details, okay? I go usually over those details when I focus on the modeling aspects of that. In this case, I just want to emphasize the material science, okay? Another constraint that you will find is that if you look at this whole thing as a giant matrix, and that's just part of the math, then the determinant of that matrix has to be positive. Okay, it has to be positive definite, I guess, is the mathematical lingo that people specify. Okay, and that just imposes some constraints. And actually, if you think about it, that means that instead of having to determine n by 2 by n by 2 coefficients, you really look at the diagonal and any coefficients above the diagonal. Because if you have a coefficient that you know above the diagonal, you immediately know it below the diagonal. Okay, and that actually makes the problem be much easier to track, okay, or at least less experiments to determine. Okay, what are the implications to the transfer of a multi-component system that is charged, in this case a battery? What you have here is that then the mass associated, say for example, to component one, just to say something, you not only have the gradients in composition, or the gradients of chemical potential inducing mass flow, you also have that the gradients of voltage will also induce mass flow, and depending on what the charge of the ion, you can force mass to go in the direction of the gradient or in the direction opposite to the gradient, okay? think about it, right? It's not the same to have Z1 to be plus 1 than to have Z1 to be minus 1, okay? And that, you can see that contribution can work in favor of that chemical potential gradient, basically to go downhill, as we have said it a few minutes ago, or if Z has the opposite sign, it can actually go uphill, okay? Which completely changes the picture, okay? And makes it a little bit more complicated. Then there's this additional term over here, which is telling you that a mass flow of another component will also impact on how the components, the chemical components that you're looking at flow, okay? In other words, depending on the magnitude of that coupled coefficient, which, by the way, could be positive or negative, okay? There's no constraint in that regard. You can make that flow go in a non-trivial direction, okay? This is not the kind of stuff you would do analytically in a piece of paper except for very simple situations, okay? And so it's very hard actually to try to cast a homework for this that it's trackable, okay? These contributions have names, okay? So obviously the first term has to be the diffusion coefficient, okay? The second term is well known in the electronics industry as the electromigration coefficient, okay? And for those people that do intradiffusion of couples, okay, where you have, say, a metallurgical couple of, say, copper and zinc, and you put them together, you know, mass is going to go in opposite directions, that turns on that additional term, okay? And that is referred to as the osmotic pressure or chemical wind, okay? Basically, the way people have looked at it sometime is that you can have mass going in one direction, quote-unquote, pushing ions not in the direction they want, but actually pushing them back. Okay? And it's more complicated than what I'm saying. What I mean to say is that you have not only mass of all these end components and charge, but you sometimes have to include in these descriptions things like vacancies and interstitials, which you can look at as an additional component, and that will completely change or could completely change the effective rates of mass transfer in your media. Okay, and those are contributions that you have to look at. Okay, if you look at each of the components, you can see that in this case, these coefficients are coupled to each other. Okay, you can see it can get very complicated, right? As you look at each of these individual components. Okay, for electrical and ionic conductivity, the same thing. We've seen at this relationship before, okay? But now, besides having the conductivity term that we all know, okay, now you have the electromigration contribution associated with that. And notice here that I don't have not only one migration contribution, but have as many as charged species are associated with that, okay? And you have to account for them. Interestingly enough, you can find the exact same equation without using any of this machinery that I just showed you simply by saying that, where am I going to put that? Let's put it here. You can simply say that mass flux is proportional to some coefficient. Okay? And of course, if this was only one component, we would say it's proportional to the gradient of chemical potential. Right? Traditionally, we would say that. Okay? But when you have a charged medium, you could also say, well, at equilibrium, I would expect not the chemical potentials to be, to have no gradients. I would expect the electrochemical potentials to be uniform across my system. Okay? Those are the driving forces, right? Those gradients. So you can also say similar coefficient. Oops. Okay? The electrochemical potential. Okay? Where if you remember, way back when we were talking about equilibrium, right? Which we can just put in there. Okay? And we can make it look just like that. Okay? In the exact same way. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay? So ultimately, you want to account for all the gradients that are moving your system away from that equilibrium condition. Okay? And if you deviate from those conditions, then the system will try to go as fast as possible to its equilibrium condition, inducing with that a redistribution of mass, charge, and heat to try to balance that out. The only reason that I don't present it in this way, but I present the other more generalized approach is because there's no guarantee that if I write it this way, my entropy will increase, which, in my personal opinion, satisfying the first and second law of thermodynamics, it's a critical requirement to have a description that actually has hope of being correct. Okay? You can arrive to a description that accidentally satisfies the laws of thermodynamics, but I think, also in my personal opinion, you will be taking a big risk, but not satisfying them. Okay? So I'd rather start from something that satisfy by construction the first and second law than just accidentally manage to satisfy them. Okay? Of course, there we will be getting into another big field where we would have to come up with transport rules that satisfy the laws of thermodynamics, but that by itself, it's a very abstract topic that, well, I just want to bring up as a by the way, not as something I want to dive into. Okay? Anyway, those are the main rules of the game. Okay? And the trick, given that complexity, is how do I put those equations that I just showed you into this system? Okay? If you think about it, we not only have now something that is multiphysics, right? Because now we have fluxes and equations that are coupled to each other through different driving forces. Okay? Now we also have the additional complexity that we want to have this description applied at every point in the picture that you see up there. Okay? That's the trick. How do I put that in there? Okay? In principle, well, inside the particles, say this is, let's just pretend this green circle corresponds to a graphite particle. Okay? In there, you expect to not have any ionized lithium. Okay? Which means that that term over here is turned off. Okay? And outside, lithium, you will find lithium ions and electrons. Okay? And so you would have to basically solve for both equations at the same time, including that term. Okay? And you have to somehow track and spatially resolve all the little interstices through which this charge mass is going. It crosses the separator and then repeat the same in the counter electron. Okay? That requires a lot of heavy duty computing. Obviously, it's not something you would do by hand. Okay? You have to throw at it a big program. Okay? And deal with all the numerics, all the stiffness associated to solving that. And, well, if you put yourself in the context of 1970 something, okay? You couldn't do that back then, okay? You couldn't actually solve spatially for those equations in this problem, okay? It seemed at that time a very complex problem. In fact, it was probably not until the late 90s, early 2000s that there was enough computing power to solve something like this, okay? And instead, what Newman did, or the people in that era, Newman being the lead, since he's the one who brought everything together and applied it for a battery, what he did is say, you know what? Let's not do the whole system, okay? Let's not try to resolve spatially every single thing. That is just not possible right now. Let's not do that. Let's be smart about it, okay? Instead, I know I can take one of these spatially resolved structures that I know they're porous, and if I dig on the literature, I will find this paper that Brugmann wrote telling me that the tortuosity and the porosity are related in some way. I can do that, okay? And instead, I'm going to microstructurally average what's occurring in the electrode. I'm going to solve for the electrolyte phase completely separately from the particle phase. Because I can solve for one particle. In fact, that problem has been solved. Okay, even back then, it had already been solved. I'm just going to sketch it here. Now, forget about the fact that you have, a whole collection of particles with different possible interactions. You know, think of the one perfectly spherical particle with a boundary condition where mass is coming at a rate given by the Butler-Bromer relationship. If the overpotential of that interface is fixed, you basically have mass diffusion with a Neumann boundary condition. And you can either plug that into a numerical program in Fortran, or you can just solve it analytically. Okay? If it's something, of course, that is varying with time, then the numerical calculation is the way to go. Okay? But if the solution is with a fixed boundary condition, that solution is known, and we can solve for that. Well, if I know that solution, then all that's left is to solve the problem of the electrolyte, how mass is diffusing through the electrolyte. Or in a more precise way, how is charged mass flowing through a porous medium? Okay? And so what you do is you say, well, I'm going to ignore the particles, the diffusion inside the particles, because I can solve that separately. Instead, what I'm going to do is I'm going to average out what happens inside that particle. I'm going to replace all those details with a material with average porosity and average tortuosity, okay, and replace that with a diffusion equation that only accounts for charge distribution in that medium, okay? And I will also solve for that particle completely separately, okay? I basically try to decouple the problem, okay? Okay, then you can say, well, if I solve that, then I can do the exact same thing for the cathode. Okay, in fact, both problems, cathode and anode, are pretty much the same in that sense, except that the charge that is feeding the cathode is coming from the anode. Okay, and if I can come up with those equations, then I am set. Okay, in fact, I know that mass and charge are conserved, okay, by construction. The only trick is that that mass has to go from the particles into my microstructurally averaged media, okay, cross the separator into the microscopically averaged medium of the cathode, and then react into the particle, okay? So, let's see, let me do it over there. I have these particles, not draw too many, and instead I'm going to say that's equivalent to some system where I don't care exactly where the particles are. All I know is that it's porous, and I know that those particles are going to oppose some resistance to diffusion and ionic transfer. So I replace it with that, and I know that diffusion gradients are going to be also controlled by taking lithium, say at that spot, and transferring it to a particle that is in that position. Okay? So I can solve for this bit, provided that I also add a sink of mass. Okay? Basically take mass that is diffusing here, and at every point, okay, if the situation demands it, I'm going to put that also into a particle that represents that spot. Okay? So basically I'm saying, as compared to before, that mass accumulation at every point, okay, is not only proportional to minus the divergence of the flux, Okay? But I also now have to subtract the mass that I'm putting into the particles. Okay? Okay. Basically, I have turned this very complicated problem into an average medium problem where I add a position-dependent reaction that captures all the physics of an individual particle. Okay? And then I solve for that separately. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay. So, since that's the case, then we can say that entire region, this line basically tries to represent the through thickness of the entire electrode, right? Because now that I don't need to solve in the y and x and y direction, I only cares what happens, say, along the z direction. Then, and since every position within that plane is equivalent, then I have converted a three-dimensional problem into a 1D problem, where across the thickness of the, say, the anode, I can just solve the diffusion equation. Okay? I only need to solve for that now. Okay? Including the charge transfer, of course. Okay? But, at every point, I have to add this reaction rate where mass is being taken in and out depending on how the particles are interacting with the average medium, and assume that that particle embedded in that medium, its interactions, it's equivalent to a particle that is an infinitesimal spot right next to it. I don't mean in front, I mean closer to the separator, but, you know, a spot right next to it. Okay? And the assumption, of course, that all the particles are morphologically equivalent. Okay? Which is a big assumption if you think about it. Okay? And of course, if I do that for the anode, I can do the exact same thing for the cathode. And then I can just solve for the problem. Okay? So, philosophically, that's what it's done. Okay? And, oh, I still have time. Okay? Ah, yes, and I forgot to say. And since now I have this area per unit volume that I'm taking away, okay, this reactivity that I have added here, you can see that the more area per unit volume I put in this average medium, the more mass I'm going to be taking out and putting into the particles, okay? Say if it's an anode during recharge, and if it's a cathode, I'm going to have to take it from here and put it in the average medium during discharge. Okay? I have to do that, and I have to put it here. So somehow that reaction has to be proportional to the area per unit volume. And it also has to be proportional to the Butler-Bomer relationship at that point. Why? Because every single one of these guys has a Butler-Bomer reaction at its interface. And now I not only have that reaction, but I have that reaction per unit volume. Okay? So I have to account for that. Okay? And actually the relationship is very simple, very straightforward in that sense. Okay? Well, once you figure it out, that reaction is basically A times JBB, where in the case of JBB, the Butler-Bomer relationship being in this case in units of, say, moles per meter squared per second. Okay, and then multiply by the area density the reaction area density as we have described it before, that does indeed specify how the system is behaving. Okay? Obviously, if before we care what is the porosity of the system, now we care simultaneously about the porosity and the tortuosity of the system as well as the particle size and its reactivity. Because that will specify how fast I can remove mass from the system and put it in the particles. Okay? And now we have to comply with balance, not only on how much charge I can take from the anode and put it in the cathode, but also on how fast the mass is transferred from one side to the other one, and it's going to be limited by how fast I can intercalate it too. Okay? So all the different components we've been studying throughout the semester, they all come together here. Okay? Because now we have reaction limited system Well, we could. We have reactions in the system. We have ohmic drops as a result of the mass transfer and mass transfer itself. Okay, it can be reduced to the system we've seen before, but only in those extreme conditions. Okay? And we're going to look at those details on the next class, and how this numerical model, this model as implemented numerically, ends up being the dominant model in the world as in describing the response and battery system. And it's a beautiful system of equations. It's very elegant. In fact, it's so fast that it's probably much faster to run this these days, probably live, than to run any other model that people have. Okay, but with that simplicity, you have to also account for the assumptions that you use in order to build it. Okay, so it depends, of course, on what you're trying to do with it. Okay, any questions before we move on? Okay, then we'll discuss the rest on Friday. Okay, thank you.